Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is the award-winning journalist, Lisa Guerrero. Lisa has used her platform to make a difference. As the chief investigative correspondent at Inside Edition, she exposes scams, child abuse, and cold case murders for an audience of over 5 million viewers. You might also know Lisa from her career as a sports reporter in the male-dominated world of sports broadcasting, where she famously made Dennis Rodman cry. It's true, it's on tape. Today, I'll be talking with Lisa about her new memoir, Warrior, My Path to Being Brave. If you like what you hear, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and tell your friends. Okay, let's dive in. So I cannot believe you. You look so good for just getting off an airplane. At least it wasn't the red eye, right? Because you're going this direction, you're going flying west.
You know, thank God for Visine and concealer and coffee, like my third cup today. So here we go.
Yay. And so how has it been going, the tour?
Beyond my wildest expectations, honestly. I was just asked to do the Christine Amanpour show this morning for...
Oh my goodness.
I know. The reaction and the warm embrace of women and the people who have supported me and people who have apologized to me, it's just been remarkable, honestly, Jen.
Where are they? Wait, CNN moved its studios a couple years ago, right before the pandemic, and I'm forgetting where they are. They're over... Is she over at CNN Studios?
So I'm doing my interview via Zoom with Michelle Martin, who's one of her correspondents.
Oh, I get it. You didn't do it while you were in New York.
No.
I thought you meant before you hopped on a 7 a.m. plane
did
an interview.
No, they just this morning asked me to do it for next week. So I just got the invitation. Oh. And I'm such a, you know, wildly, like, huge fangirl of Christine Amanpour and Michelle Martin as well. So
yes.
I'm thrilled to do it, and I'm glad they read the book.
I mean, you know, there's a cliche that people say, like, they couldn't put a book down, but I literally... could not put this book down. When I read it, I just kept reading and going through it. And so much resonates, even though we don't share the same story. But your support for other women and finding out how really that's a key to our happiness and our career survival is supporting each other. And I really find that incredibly moving. I wanted to share something with you. Hold on. So this is, this one's missing the pom-pom. This is one of my cheerleading trophies. And this one is from 1975. For 3 years in my childhood, I was a Little League cheerleader for my brother's Little League football team.
Amazing. See how many people have been cheerleaders? See, it's very common.
It was, but what I didn't know until I read your book is... how heavy the real pom-poms are. Because when I was a little kid, they were just made of nothing, like plastic. But what do you think, like weight-wise? Is it like 10 pounds each or how heavy are they? Or 5 pounds?
They're probably about five. They have wooden cores, at least back in the 80s. They had these wood chunk cores. And they would, you know, somehow drill metallic, you know, the metallic strings onto these things that they would put in the core. And you would actually grasp, so you're doing your cheerleading or dancing like this with claws because you're grasping these pom-poms. And they were, and of course, because in the NFL stadiums, you've got 60,000 people and you're cheering to the highest levels. The pom-poms were huge. They were like this big. You know, really big pom-poms.
Oh, my God.
So very heavy because they needed to be able to see them from the top of the stadium.
Right, to be visual.
So, that's right.
The thing about cheerleading, it kind of reminds me of a sport like figure skating or gymnastics where audience who don't know better and possibly because of the way the body type's chosen for those sports and those activities, they look slim or they look sleek and people don't realize how much endurance, how strong you have to be to compete or participate in these, and how much it is that, and maybe it's a metaphor for some ways in which the expectations are for girls and women to behave. Like, we're supposed to make it look like everything we do is effortless, seamless, when it requires work and pain, which brings me to so much of what you talk about in the book. Like, on the surface, how you were coping and surviving, but beneath us, sometimes you were scared or fighting or going through really painful moments. And I hesitate. I know that you wrote about your history, but is it okay? Is anything off limits, or is anything going to sort of trigger any kind of trauma if we talk about it?
Thank you for asking that, first of all, Jen. But no, I am a completely open book about my book and about my life. The reason I wrote it so specifically and with some very uncomfortable details in some places is that I wanted to be honest about it. I wanted people to feel, if they could, to try to empathize with some of what I was going through. So I have decided nothing's off limits. The only thing I have chosen not to reveal is the exact date, the exact game that I had the miscarriage at, because I didn't want people pulling up video and trying to freeze frame and decide, okay, this is where she's cramping. This is, I just thought that was too much. So that's the only thing I'm kind of keeping to myself, you know, just for the dignity of that woman who was enduring that back then. I don't want her, that younger me, to feel like people are trying to find the grief and pain in her face 20 years later.
Mm. And so that's maybe one of the hardest things in this book, I think, taken together with the loss of your own mother, kind of both ends of life, right? You know, you lost your mother at a very young age and fortunately had an incredible, supportive, amazing father. And then you miscarried.
Yes.
And you didn't tell anyone. People knew about the death of your mother.
Correct.
But you didn't ever talk about trying to become a mother, or accidentally thinking, well, this might happen in it, and then having this miscarriage. Why did you wait till now to share that story? And how is it feeling with you know, millions of people knowing about that now?
I went back and forth, to be honest, about when I was writing the book, do I want to include this? When I first started writing my story, it was a much lighter version of the book that you see today. I started writing a series of essays about what it was like for the only woman in a locker room, and, you know, for the Dodgers or with the Lakers. And of course, there were very funny, uncomfortable, awkward experiences that lent itself to a more humorous take on my career and my life. But as I started to dig deep and I started to pull the videos, and, you know, because I researched myself, and I went through old journals, and I saw how deeply in pain I was and how I pushed it down and decided to forge on, get through the next game, ignore the fact that, you know, that colleague just grabbed my ass in a media scrum trying to get an interview with Kobe. But I wrote about it in my diaries and in my calendars and in letters to people and in conversations with my friends and my family. So when I did the research, I decided, no, this is not the book I should be writing. I shouldn't be writing a funny book. And it had a great title, Between a Jock and a Hard Place. I thought, okay, this is great. I'm going to just, you know, really have fun writing this book. Well, it was not a fun process to research it. And I said, okay, if I'm going to write it, let's go ahead and write the truth. And you've read the book, so you know that I name names and I talk about a lot of details.
Yes.
About a lot of things. And I did that because I don't want this to happen to other young women. And I wanted to apologize to the younger me for not having the courage to stand up for her. And the me today,
you
wouldn't take that kind of abuse, you know, at 58. But, you know, in my 20s and 30s, I really did. And
we didn't have the choices, because we knew, first of all, you're young. Second of all, at that time, it was happening everywhere. And you know, and you're also you. But how does it feel to apologize to that younger self?
It's
have you
cathartic.
Has she forgiven you?
I think she has, and I know that I was, like many women, just trying to navigate an industry that was rife with pitfall, potential disaster. And, you know, when you're a woman in sports,
yes.
I remember like trying to file my reports after games and not walking down certain halls to avoid certain executives at night. I really remember being careful about walking out to the parking lot after Dodgers games because it was late at night. It was after I filed for the 11 o'clock show. And I was physically nervous about my safety, and I had just been hit on by somebody, a colleague or a player or an executive. So I dealt with stuff that my male colleagues didn't even think about. You know, they're there to cover the game. They cover the game, they go home. For me, it's like, okay, what am I going to wear today that won't piss people off, that will make me feel good, that will make me feel strong, that will make me feel feminine, that won't seem to be inviting, you know, innuendo. So there's the whole discussion I had with myself before I even left my house. Dudes don't do that. They throw on a members only jacket and their toupee and they're off. totally different thing.
I mean, it's just such a catch 22 because if you're a woman who's going to be in the public eye, you know, there is this, the way in which you need a certain level of attractiveness or presentation in order to, you know, this was the case at, you know, sometimes, especially television news, which you do and did, and also sports and also acting. And yet, if you're perceived as too beautiful, then how'd you get your job? As if, what? Like, you know, where is the, there's, and you talk, so anyway, but, it's you just said a bunch of stuff about dropping names, but I wanna make sure that I recognize for you that I get that although you were a great cheerleader when you auditioned for the Los Angeles Rams, what got you onto the team was your knowledge of sports. I mean, it was a very tough audition and you'd been on the drill team.
Yeah, in high school.
but it was your father and you bonding together over sports, and you kind of at the interview showed people what you knew. And so that's to me the deepest irony that first job was because you worked really, really hard to learn the moves, very athletic, very difficult to do that. You had the knowledge and you carry that preparation, knowledge and hard work for every job along the way, and yet someone could still try to grab your ass and also make comments at that roast that you write about, you know, suggesting that you slept your way to the top. And whenever people even say that, I think, you know, a lot of women sleep their way to the bottom. So
right, exactly.
You know, and also a lot of men play golf and hang out and go to strip clubs with their guys. I mean, and I'm not saying in every field, but like, you know, even if you have a relationship, romantic or friendship with someone in your office or in your field, that's not how people get to the top of their profession. And yet there is a lot of camaraderie among men. And yet no one ever says, oh, he got that promotion because he lets that guy cheat at golf.
You're making a great point. And I kind of allude to this a little bit in the book, that the male sports reporters seem to me to be sidling up to the players in order to, you know, befriend them, in order to hang out with the players, in order to go play golf with them, you know, to be in that circle of dude, bro, athlete and, you know, reporters. And, I didn't, but you're right. Nobody would blink an eye if those guys all got together, you know, after a road game and went to a strip bar, which I know they were doing all the time. I saw my colleagues hanging out with players doing stuff like that. And nobody cares. Nobody cares. And I was very careful when I was a reporter to really separate my personal life from my work life. And in fact, when I later did marry a baseball player, I had never met him or interviewed him. So he was somebody that wasn't somebody in my circle that I worked with or dealt with or a colleague or a person I covered. But, you know, I think there's definitely a different standard for men and women in sports. But, you know, it's like that really. And, you know, I use sports because I'm from the world of sports. But this is such a universal right. issue for women. It's not specific to sports.
Yes. No, I, after law school, I went in-house at one business, and then I went and worked at an investment firm, which is also, you know, worked off of a trading floor. That's very similar group of folks. But I, you know, that's the stuff I'm interested in. I mean, the way that you're interested in sports is the way that I'm interested in money and finance. Although I did grow up with a family that loved Michigan football and they had, you know,
because Spartans
Detroit,
was
mean,
everything color
Lions.
Coordinated and had all the Spartans.
Oh, no, they hated the Spartans.
Oh.
They were Wolverine fans.
Oh, okay.
They, Spartans were,
Michigan,
yes.
Wait, Michigan?
They hated Michigan
State. Yes, got it.
Yes, that was a big rivalry in Ohio State. And so I had to go to the home football games every week. And so, like, I, you know, I enjoy watching football. And of course, I did the little league cheerleading, but I sort of always resented growing up that. My parents would go to every little league football game for my older brother. But if I had a dance performance, it was once a year. If my mother wanted to go see the Nutcracker down, I'm from Michigan and wanted to see it like at, I don't know, I guess it was at Avery Fisher Hall, wanted to see the Nutcracker. My father would be like, oh, a ballet. And I'm like, every twice a week we have football games in the cold,
no.
you know, so
oh,
I,
no,
I also, I also wanted to play. So you know how I showed you that trophy? I was at this. It was like it probably was like 1975, and they were giving awards to all the football players and all the cheerleaders. And there was a young girl who played football that was very rare at that time, and she got an award. And so I told my mother that I wanted to play football too. But of course, I mean, I'm like, you know, five. I'm now 5'4", but at that time I was this tiny little kid. And so she said no, which is probably the right move. But I want to talk about you, about your mom and how you took her name later. And there's something you write in your book about after your mother died and she didn't get a chance to really leave a note for you. Like you looked around her room for a note and you found a lipstick. I think it was a gold metallic lipstick. In a pillowcase, and you took those mementos. Do you still have those?
I don't. And here's a very interesting part of the story that I didn't write because I didn't know about it until after I wrote the book. I looked for mm-hmm. a long time after I grew up and we moved. I looked for a lot of that stuff, and I said, Dad, where's Mom's stuff? Where's her jewelry? Where are her clothes? Where she did macrame. Again, you know, late 60s into early 70s, she crocheted. Yeah. Where are these pieces of art? Where's her stuff? And I remember for years, Dad would be like, oh, I don't know. I'm, you know, maybe we got, of course, I looked at him like, how could you get rid of them? Now I know he was in grief. He was 31 years old. He had just lost his wife and he had two small kids. So we just found out last year, Jen, my dad calls me and he said, Lisa, you're not going to believe this. I need you to meet me at my bank. And I thought, like, what does he need me to sign something for him? Is he okay? I meet him at his bank and he's got, you know, he looks very emotional. And he said, we're going to go into the safety deposit box. And he goes, this is an old safety deposit box I brought up from San Diego. And I shoved it in here because I couldn't look in it. But it's your mother's jewelry. And I put it in this box the day she died because I couldn't look at it. I couldn't bear to look at it. And then I put it in this, you know, the safety deposit box. And he brought it from San Diego to Huntington Beach, where he now lives, and hasn't opened it ever in 49 years. So I was with him. We opened it and we just cried because we remembered her in all of this South American jewelry she collected. You know, she's from Chile. And so every time she would go to see her family or we'd go as a family down there, she would collect this Chilean and Peruvian jewelry. And it was all in this box. So what we did was, you know, my dad gave it to me. And so throughout every single day of my book tour, including today, I'm wearing some part of that jewelry. There's not a day throughout this entire time, because the book is named for her. So every day I find one piece of jewelry to wear that is part of that collection. So yes, I do have her with me today.
Wow. She's with you. And she gave you some words too. I mean, she told you something about your name. And I'm trying to remember, was that when you were younger or about, I think you were around eight?
Yeah, right before she died.
Can you?
Yeah, I can explain.
So how did that guy, the diagnosis was pretty, it was pretty quick. How did that all happen? And how did she tell you that message?
It was shockingly fast. You know, she was 29 and beautiful. She looked like Sophia Loren, healthy, working for the Salvation Army as a translator and in the food pantry at the Salvation Army in San Diego downtown with my dad, who is the director of social services for the Salvation Army there. So they worked together, and she looked great and was healthy. Right before the holidays, she had a cough and couldn't get rid of the cough. And my dad said, you need to go to the doctor, but she couldn't get an appointment during the holidays. So, you know, she had a lump in her throat and the lump got bigger and bigger. So after the holidays, she goes in. Immediately they knew there was something wrong. They did a biopsy and she ended up having lymphoma, which had spread all over to all of the lymph nodes.
Lisa.
So
oh.
within 2 months she died.
Yes.
So we found out around Christmas and she died the night before Valentine's Day. So, you know, very quickly. And I was eight, Richard was six, my dad was 31 and my mom was 29 when she passed away. So it was very fast. But before she died, she knew that she was sick. They did radical surgery to try to remove as many of these lymph nodes as they could very quickly. And so she pulled me aside and she said, Lisita, which she's little, Lisita is little Lisa in Spanish. Lisita, never forget that your last name is Guerrero, and Guerrero means warrior in Spanish. You were born to fight. And I had no idea what that meant. I honestly did. It was gibberish. I didn't understand what this meant. However, I will tell you that I do now know what it meant. I know that she was leaving me the message. The note that I had looked for those months and years was actually what she told me. The gift she gave me was my heritage, was my name. You know, I'm a guerrero. I'm born to fight.
She gave you that, and you did finally take her surname as yours, because your father's name is Coles.
Right, Walter Coles, yeah.
And you took that on. Around the time you took her name on, did you feel strong? Because I think about you being a warrior, and yet you tell the story about how you were sometimes losing the war.
Yeah.
And there are times when that you were embattled, but you chose that to take her name on, wasn't it, when you were having an acting career and sports casting and you wanted to kind of keep those lives separate?
I was told when I started in the industry that you can't be both a sports caster and an actor. You've got to choose. You got to choose one. You can't be a broadcaster and an actor. So Who makes these rules?
I mean, it's so silly when you think about it.
I decided to be sneaky and make two different headshots and have two different resumes. And I used Lisa Coles as an actor and Lisa Guerrero as a broadcaster, and started going out on different auditions for each separately. I had two different agents and they didn't know that I was doing this. Well, all of a sudden, the two worlds collide because I start to work in both industries. And suddenly there's you know, a time when I had to tell the other agent that I'm actually doing both. And it was a big brouhaha. And I decided at one point to combine the names, Lisa Guerrero Coles, which is awkward and a mouthful. And ultimately, when I got the job on Sunset Beach as an actor, I got one of the leads on the Aaron Spelling soap opera. On the same day, I got an offer at KCBS2 as a weekend sports reporter. And I said, okay, the jig is up here. I mean, I'm just going to be who I am. And who I am is Lisa Guerrero. So I legally changed my name to Lisa Guerrero. And from then on, that became my name. And so that was, and it was funny too, because early on I had a manager who said, if you change your name to Guerrero, you're going to destroy your career. You'll only get cast as maids or, you know, girlfriend of a gang member if you're Guerrero. If you're Coles, you're white enough to look like you're white.
Wow.
So you don't, you can play anything if you stay Lisa Coles. If you're Guerrero, you're going to be labeled, you know, as a Latina. And so instead of taking his direction, I decided to change managers. And I got a manager who supported me in the decision to be Guerrero, who I, and that's who I am.
It's kind of amazing to me that you got these two jobs and managed to go to both of these jobs, that you were filming. You had a really choice role, really awesome role in Sunset Beach, the soap opera, Barron Spelling Show, while you were also doing this sports casting. So you've got to learn your lines. You've got to be out in the cold or out at night at these games. How did you balance it all?
I did not have a life outside of these two jobs. I was young. I was ambitious. I was tenacious. I was insane. I ate no real food. I lived off of Snickers bars and Doritos and junk food, going to and from stadiums. And I didn't have a boyfriend at that time.
I love the part of the book where you like figure it out.
Yeah, I
love the part where you figure it out how to eat. Like you would figure out where the closest McDonald's was on your route between the two jobs.
Yes, I had it all mapped out. So if I'm going to cover the Lakers at Staples Center, then, you know, there's a Pollo Loco over there. But if I cover, you know, the Dodgers and I have to go out to Chavez Ravine, first of all, make sure I eat a Dodger dog that's free in the press, you know, the press club area that where we have to sit, the press room. There were free Dodger dogs in the seventh inning. So I would load up on those. And then I'd be hungry on the way home. There'd be a 24-hour Del Taco. I knew where that was. So I knew where all the junk food was, depending on what sports I was covering. I didn't have, you know, I basically didn't see my friends and family that whole year, 13 months, I think I went straight without having a day off. And I didn't, you know, of course I didn't have kids and I wasn't married, which, you know, was an advantage because I didn't have to worry about anybody but my cat. And he was pretty self-sufficient cat.
Right.
So that was it. Me and my cat.
I mean, you're really resourceful. And it's funny because by that time in your career, you were probably making decent money as compared to what I found out reading your book were the shockingly low wages, if you can call them that, from the days when you were doing the cheerleading. I want to read this because I can't even believe it. And I want to say it out loud to see if it also blows your mind, even though you wrote it. And this, I think, is from the LA Rams days. We were compensated $25 per game, plus about $75 for corporate events. And we were expected to do dozens of team and charity events for free. And that doesn't even include the cost of getting your haircut, makeup, uniforms, tans, nails, exercise. What in the world? Why is it? Because it's a stepping stone? I mean, I know they could exploit women, but why do so many women, or did they want to do these jobs when they didn't pay?
Yeah, and especially back then, you know, this is the 80s, and so we're coming out of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader era, right? And that was kind of the 70s. And now here we're in the 80s, and I think especially in Los Angeles, there were professional actresses, models, and dancers that looked at the opportunity with the Rams and with the Lakers as a platform to potentially getting an agent, to have an opportunity to perform as a dancer, to stay in shape, to have a sisterhood.
Right.
I was really drawn to it for the sisterhood element of it because I didn't have a mother or sisters. Mm-hmm. So I found my female tribe through the Rams cheerleading. But but I think for a lot of us, it was an opportunity at, you know, show business, the entertainment business. And, you know, that was the dream that was kind of sold, right? You know, you're going to be, you're a star, you're a celebrity. Well, that's ridiculous. You are a poorly paid dancer on the sidelines.
But to some degree, even though it was a lot of hours, a lot of work, low pay, you did have the sisterhood. And it sounds like a lot of people did do what you're saying, which is use it as stepping stone. You got to be a sports, well, you had that other knowledge, but you got to be an actor, sports newscaster. Is that most of the people that you knew went on to other things, or was it kind of a dead end for some people?
So I think what ended up happening is most people were in college at that same time they were cheering for the Rams, and they got their degrees and they moved on in business. And they, you know, when now the women that I know that I cheered with are, you know, educators, lawyers, real estate professionals, you know, homemakers, you know, people that have, you know, I've got an executive, one of them was an executive at Nordstrom. So they all went on to pursue their own careers. Very few of us went into entertainment. I did, you know, I pursued that and I got an agent and used the connections I had through cheerleading to help me with modeling and other things. So I took advantage of that part of the entertainment business, but most women didn't, you know, they just went on to have their own lives and careers mm-hmm. that they pursued through their degrees that they were getting in college.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that shocked me and was of quite of great interest to me because, you know, I live in Massachusetts now. And so our football team is the New England Patriots. And since you name names, I'm just going to ask you about it. Jonathan Kraft, son of the then owner, Robert Kraft, who's had his own complicated history with the law and with massage parlors. At any rate, when Jonathan was given the job of running entertainment at the time that you were coaching, I guess the team called at the Patriots. Do they have a name for the cheerleading?
We did. I was the director and choreographer for the Patriots. That's what they were.
Patriots
at the time. The Patriots cheerleaders. And
you really. Go ahead. Tell me what happened with Jonathan.
So I had worked for three different owners in three different years for the Patriots. Mm-hmm. As you recall, there were James Bush Orthwine, Victor Kiam, Robert Kraft were three separate owners in three separate years. So I interviewed with each of them. And previous to this, I had been the director for the Falcons for 3 years. So I was a seasoned veteran, you know, director and choreographer at that point. You know, Robert Kraft interviews me. I get the job. You know, I continue to do the job that I did, which was a professional, really great job as a director and choreographer, I might add. Had hired the cheerleaders, choreographed their routines, designed their uniforms, shot all of the publicity, the posters, calendars, trained them through training camp and rehearsals. And suddenly, right before the season starts, Jonathan Kraft, who's Robert Kraft's son, who at that time was my age, about 29 years old. And it was the first time he'd ever worked for a team. He'd never been in the NFL, but they made him my boss. So he's basically overseeing entertainment and the cheerleaders. So mm-hmm. here's this guy that, you know, had never been a part of the NFL, didn't know anything about, you know, professional cheerleading or being, you know, an ambassador in the community as a cheerleader. So he's my boss. And I started to butt heads with him pretty quickly. He wanted the cheerleaders to wear sexier uniforms. I said no. He wanted them in high-heeled boots, like, quote, he said, like the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. And at that point, we were at the old Foxborough Stadium, which was outdoor, mm-hmm. cheering in the mud and the rain and the snow. So I said, no, we're not putting them in sexier uniforms. No, we're not putting them in high heel boots. They cheered in tennis shoes because it was muddy and wet.
Right.
So I butted heads with him throughout this season. And suddenly I'm called into his office and he wants to see my playlist for the music that I chose for the choreography for the dancers, the cheerleaders mm-hmm. throughout the game. And I, you know, there's about 30 different clips of music that were played at halftime, or excuse me, quarter changes, timeouts, 2 minute warnings. So about 30 different pieces of music. And I made mm-hmm. sure that those pieces of music were diverse, you know, some country, some rock, some pop, some oldies, you know, stuff people like. So I turned in my music list and Jonathan looked at it and he said, I want you to take all the black music off here.
Holy shit.
And I thought I misheard him. I, my 29-year-old self had never experienced anything like this before. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, look up in the stands. You don't see any black faces up there.
Oh my God.
And my heart dropped because all of a sudden I realized what he's telling me. He's telling me to take the black artists off the playlist.
Right.
And I said, look at the team. That 70% are black players. Everybody loves Michael Jackson. I had Aretha Franklin, Michael Jackson, MC Hammer was the 90s. Prince.
It's all good.
Like everybody loves all this music. You know, why are you making this something that it's not? So he said, come back tomorrow. I want the new list. So I went home. I was beside myself. I called my dad. I cried. I had already been butting heads with him. And I talked to my dad and he said,
well, it sounds like he came in deciding not to treat you like a person who had any authority, but to just crush your will.
Absolutely.
But anyway, go ahead.
That's how I felt. So I thought about it overnight and talked to my dad and I went back the next day, went into his office, turned in the exact same playlist, and I was fired shortly thereafter. But the problem for them was that I had a signed contract. I had a contract with them. So I just dug into the then Yellow Pages, started calling every lawyer I could find. Nobody wanted to take the case. And finally, I found a man who I believe at the time he was in Lynn, Massachusetts, Fred Golder. And he was, of all things, an employment expert. And said, come on in, tell me, bring all your stuff. And he said right there, he goes, you have a case. They owe you the balance of your contract. You have a signed contract. They don't have any reason to fire you. So we decided to go to, what is it, mediation or arbitration?
Either one depends on what your agreement, yeah.
I forget which one we did. But we
probably arbitration.
We went to a real judge. We were sworn in. Me and my lawyer and Robert Kraft and Jonathan Kraft and their team all went together. We were all sworn in. We pled our cases. We took the stand. And I had all of my paperwork, all of my files, including a signed card from Robert Kraft that he had just given me.
That's right.
Saying how great I was, what a great addition to the team, how proud he was of the cheerleaders and of me. So I brought that card in, and later I found out that that was one of the things that really swung the judge my way, because of course Jonathan denied ever saying this to me, of course, that he said he never said that about the music. And, you know, again, why did you fire me? There's no other reason. The cheerleaders were trained. They were ready. And the timing was suspect. And the judge believed me. So he found for me. So at the end of the day, they wrote me a check. And so I won my case. And that's the story.
And that was a long time ago. But what happened to you won the case, but you had a team. They must have been devastated that you left, because he put someone else in. They didn't know.
I was directed to not reach out to the cheerleaders. I was not allowed to tell them what happened. I was not allowed to say goodbye. I was not allowed to share with them what was asked of me. It was devastating for me because I felt a maternal bond to these women. I was their director and choreographer. I hired them. I taught them. I pick them up if their boyfriend broke up with them from from a diner in the middle of the night. I mean, this is my team. And so I was devastated to not be able to, and they said, you cannot reach out to them. And so I moved home, and it was really a sad thing. It was a sad end to an amazing 10-year experience in NFL entertainment as a cheerleader and then as a director.
And you described those, I mean, you're talking about how, you know, you drive your team, you know, different places if they needed you, and you were there, shoulder to cry, because you describe yourself as kind of being a mom, even though you weren't that much older. And I see that in your kind of warrior spirit, even what you bring into your investigative reporter work at Inside Edition. I mean, it's like, you remind me of the remake of Wonder Woman. I mean, the Wonder Woman movie where she, it's like, you know which one I mean, with a gal.
Yeah,
what's
Gadot.
Her name? Her last name.
Gadot.
Yes, and she's fighting the Nazis, but she's bringing her strength. It's so I can't describe it. It's like warm and nurturing, fighting, you know, and that's what I see you doing. And I want to ask you about these brave yet very emotional confrontations that you describe. And one of them is how you begin the book, talking about Juliet and her aunt Monica. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, you know, as an investigative reporter for Inside Edition, part of what I get to do is help pitch story ideas. And so I reach out a lot on social media. Do you have an idea for me? You know, feel free to pitch to me. And a woman named Monica Hall reached out to me on Facebook, and she said that her niece, Juliet Gertz, had been beaten to death in her crib 4 years prior. The case had gone cold. This was in Nebraska, a small police department, and they bungled the case and the crime scene. So all three adults, one of them beat this child to death in a small house. Oh. So all three of them knew what happened. But all three of them had now moved to other states. Law enforcement claimed they didn't know where they were. And so Monica was desperate for somebody to reopen and take a look at the case. So she reached out to the media, hoping that this would spur something, you know, to happen and to find justice for Juliet. So she reached out to me. I talked my senior producer, Bob Reed, into letting me take my team out there to start to poke around. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, we were able to track down where all three of those adult suspects went to different states. And we confronted them. We found them. We confronted them. We asked them tough questions. And two of the three rolled over on Dustin Chauncey. Dustin Chauncey was the little girl's mother's boyfriend at the time. And they both said that he had beaten her to death. And so they admitted this on camera. We aired it. And then, you know, a grand jury found that you know, there was enough evidence to charge him. And I was in the courtroom a couple of years later, sitting right next to Monica Hall, when Dustin Chauncey was found guilty. He is now spending 80 years to life in prison. In part because of our investigation and Monica Hall's tenacity in gathering signatures to get this, you know, grand jury to take a look at this case. So I think we had a good 1-2 punch going, and I'm still great friends with Monica today. And I sent her a copy of the book because her story starts the book. And it's one of my proudest moments as a journalist.
It really should be. And when you're describing, this story, you're modest because there's so much bravery. And to me, the hardest thing that you did, you talk about there were three adults there when Juliet was killed. One of them was her mother. And you found, with your investigative team, you found the mom and you asked her whether she killed her daughter. That is really hard to do. And she cried. And then she said that this boyfriend had done it. But it's hard and uncomfortable. It's got to be one of the hardest things you can do. And yet it was for the greater good. I mean, you're putting this person, obviously that was not what she wanted for her daughter. She did stay with him for a while. It's not good to cover this up. I mean, what a disaster of a situation. She should have turned him in, but still, obviously she was in pain. And you knew that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But you understood what you needed to do. I think that's incredibly courageous.
Thank you. Everything, people see me running around, like chasing, we say bad guys. we do this. And of course, it's television. So there's an element of it that is, you know, exciting and people like to see that. But ultimately, I'm not doing that out of audacity. I'm doing it in service to the story and to the victims and survivors that trust me. They sit down and they tell their ugliest truths. They open up their heart. They've never had a camera in their face. And they are saying, I lost my loved one. I lost my life savings. I was sexually assaulted. Whatever it is, they trust me with their story. So then it's up to me to find accountability and to try to find justice for them, or at the very least, face somebody and ask them the questions that this person would want me to ask, because they don't get a chance to ask it. You know, they're not chasing after him with a camera. I am. And so what would they want me to ask him? So that's where I'm coming from when I do this. I know it looks like I'm brave and I'm out there like with a swagger and just, you know, theatrics, but it's really in service to the victim and the survivor.
I mean, that is absolutely clear to me, also knowing because I come from the legal profession, that you're not going to be able to get justice if you don't have attention, if you don't shine a light on these facts. The other thing that I also think is incredibly courageous, and it's how I first learned of you, actually, was that that video that went viral, I think a billion people saw, of that crazy-eyed preacher and his Jets for Jesus. How did that all happen?
Well, Kenneth Copeland, you know, is this massively rich televangelist, and he's been around forever. I mean, decades. He's you know, just made so much money, and he's got so many devoted followers. And, you know, we had started doing stories about him years before. We did another story about, you know, him living this luxurious lifestyle, where, you know, he's asking his donors in some cases to, you know, turn over the very little money that they had. We had interviewed a woman whose mother was dying of cancer, and she watched him on TV, and she sent him all her life savings because he said he would pray over the money, and she never went to a doctor. So she died. She left her daughter with nothing. And so I interviewed her years before for the first story about him and other preachers like that called Rockstar Preachers. So several years later, we found out that, you know, he's still at it. Now he's buying private jets with donors' money. But worse, he, on a TV show, he said that he didn't ever want to fly commercial because he didn't want to get into a tube full of demons, which is presumably human beings are, or who, people that just fly coach or something, were demons, apparently, to him. And so that's why he flies private, so he doesn't have to get into a tube full of demons. So I thought, well, you know, my producer and I, Larry Posner, and our photojournalist, Phil Capsa, went to Missouri. We knew that he was doing a seminar out there. And we, you know, first tried to reach out. By the way, we try to reach out first, usually, with these stories to see if somebody will sit down with us. They didn't get back to us. So we went to them and we just waited for several days outside of the seminar he was doing. And finally, he came out and I ran up to him and he stopped and you know, agreed to talk to me. And so this, I think it was a 12-minute interview that we ended up showing in full on our website, uncut. First, we just showed a clip of it in the original investigation. But then when we put the entire uncut version of it online, it went viral because it was bananas. And I, you know, just wanted really to ask him about this quote, about, you know, why he was spending this kind of money on luxurious multiple private planes. And if you know, if that was fair to his donors. And it became quite some. If you haven't seen it, all you have to do is Google Kenneth Copeland and Inside Edition and watch the uncut version. It's quite something.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to watch it again. I can be one of the many billions who watch it again. You also encountered, I mean, you've had, you know, you've met presidents. You've even met Jordan Belfort, the Stratton Oakmont securities fraudster, who they made the movie, and he wrote a book called The Wolf of Wall Street. What was that encounter like, and how did that come about?
Here's another person that I've had a couple of encounters with. We did our we did our original story with him several years ago. We caught up with him outside an airport, and we asked him when he was planning to pay back his victims. Of course, he owes his victims millions of dollars. And many of those victims, these were penny stocks. So these were people that weren't rich that lost, in some cases, their life savings with him. And, you know, he paid the price for a little while, spent some time in prison. But, you know, when he got out, the deal was he's got to pay these people back. Well, we found him living this luxurious lifestyle and, you know, taking these incredible vacations, a beach house, you know, in Los Angeles, and, you know, skiing and like living it up. And he wasn't paying these people back. So I caught up with him to ask him when he was planning to be, and his bodyguard gets in the way, shoves me. There's a little, you know, dust up. He ignores me. Well, I had one of his victims with me. And I asked him to pay attention. You know, please, can you listen to him? He's lost his entire life savings with you. And so his victim was trying to talk to him. We really just followed him through the airport trying to get. So that was the first story. And then the second story was us going to London. He was doing one of these seminars with, you know, wannabe Jordan Belforts. And these tickets were like $500 a pop, sold out. And at the end of it, and we bought tickets.
And this is after he's gone to jail. Yes. By the way, this is after he's gone to jail. People want to learn from him.
Yes, correct.
Wow.
Correct.
What a world.
What a world. So there's a question and answer period at the end of his seminar. And we bought tickets, so we were allowed to go in there. And I went up and I grabbed the microphone to ask him a question. And of course, my question is, I'm Lisa Guerrero with Inside Edition. You told me a couple of years ago you were planning to pay back your, and he told me at the time during the first confrontation that he was going to pay him back that fall. And I said, you told me 2 years ago you're going to pay your victims back that fall. Where is the money that you owe your victims? You owe them millions of dollars. And then the crowd starts booing me. Security starts to grab my microphone. I'm hustled out of there. And of course, he was so flustered, he ended up leaving the stage and cut his event short. But again, today, Jordan Belfort, I would love to sit down and talk to you. Where's the money that you owe your victims? Where is it? They're still waiting.
Well, I hope he listens to Booked Up. And if he does, if you can't somehow find Lisa on Inside Edition, you can always email me, Jen Taub, at bookedup@politicon.com or drop me a note in my PO box. So I have to tell you, Lisa, if I were ever speaking in public and I saw you in the audience at the Q&A, ready to ask questions, I would just leave the stage because you, not only did you scare away Jordan Belfort, but you also made Dennis Rodman cry. Can you tell me how that even came about?
I didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't my intention. I was a young sports reporter. I had just been hired by CBS2 in Los Angeles. It was one of my first press conferences. And at the time, Dennis Rodman, a very big star at the time, coming off of his incredible career with the Bulls, he was considering whether or not to sign with the Lakers. And so we were waiting to find out if he was going to sign, what the timing would be. There had been rumors for a long time. And so he finally calls this press conference at Planet Hollywood. And so all the press shows up. Now, this is during the time we talked about before where I'm on a soap opera Mondays through Fridays, and I'm a sportscaster during the weekends and two nights a week for CBS. I had a rare afternoon off from my soap opera, and I get called in to do this press conference that day. So I was exhausted. I was excited because I was a Dennis Rodman fan and a Laker fan. I wanted to see this happen.
But and you're going to get the scoop, you think?
Yes. And I'm hoping to maybe try to interview him afterwards, get a one-on-one. I had to do a live report in the afternoon. So at any rate, I'm waiting for him, like everybody else is, you know, mainly men in this press conference. And I'm wearing a pink Barbie suit that I stole from the set of my soap opera because I was stealing Francesca's wardrobe all the time to wear on the air. So I'm in this pink suit. Nobody really knew who I was in that room. I was a new sportscaster. And finally, he rolls in at least a half an hour late with Carmen Electra, who was his girlfriend at the time.
Oh my
and
God.
They just smelled like vodka and weed and sweat. And I could smell it on them from the front row. And I was like, oh my goodness, what is going on? And he had an entourage of people with him. So he gets up to the stage and they start talking about their sex life. This was, by the way, being carried on ESPN Live.
Unbelievable.
It was being carried live also in LA, I think on KTLA or something. So we're shocked. We're dumbfounded. And there was not even, there are no words to describe how bananas this was. And finally, he says, well, you know, here's the point. I just decided to call this press conference to see if you'd show up. I don't have any news. I don't have anything to report. I just want to see if you'd show up. And we gasped. And then I got angry. I was so angry. My ears were hot and ringing. And I just felt me flush. My body was flushed. And I stood up and I said, how dare you? you have just wasted our time. We're working and you're, this is selfish. You are the most selfish athlete I have ever heard of. And everybody is completely silent. And he's staring at me and I'm staring at him. And I'm thinking to myself, I am definitely fired at this point. Who yells at a player that's about to, a star?
Could you believe you said that?
I could not believe it.
Could you believe that came out of your mouth?
It just came out of my mouth. I was exhausted and angry and I couldn't believe it. And I stood up and had this moment. And he fired back at me after his shock wore off. He's like, listen, honey. And he did call me honey. Listen, honey, to you, but how can you call me selfish? I am the assist leader. I am the NBA all time. You know, he starts enumerating all these reasons why he's not selfish. And, you know, nobody ever understands me. Nobody gets me. I don't understand why anybody, how can you do this? And he starts sobbing, crying. And he stalks off the stage. He's still staring at me and pointing at me. Oh, and by the way, Bill Plaschke, who is a star veteran columnist for the LA Times, backed me up. All of a sudden, he stands up and he says, she's right. She's just saying what we're all thinking. You are wasting our time. You are selfish.
Oh, good.
He had my back. It was an amazing moment. And so Dennis walks off and cries and all of a sudden, everybody stares at me and then they think it's a setup. Wait, is this real? Are you an actress? And I said, yes, I am an actress, but not today. Today, I'm a sports reporter. Tomorrow, I'm an actress on a soap opera. And so that really helped make my career. Because it was carried live nationally, people wanted to know who was the girl that made Dennis Rodman cry. And Sports Illustrated did a story about me doing that. And then that launched my career. So thank you, Dennis. And thank you, Bill Plaschke.
I love that because there was this one moment. I mean, I'm sure when your ears were still hot and you said your piece and you're like, I am fired. And then you weren't. I mean, I love that you did that. And so sometimes you just have to speak truth to power. And this is kind of what you're made of, though. I mean, you stood up for your younger brother against the schoolyard bully. I mean, didn't you slug some kid who was stole his lunchbox?
Yes, and it was
like
very
that?
Wrong. Obviously, you should never, you should never resort to violence.
Yes, violence is not the answer,
as my dad never. Said afterwards. But yeah, I was a shy, dorky kid, but my brother was even more shy and smaller than I was, 2 years younger, and we both got picked on a lot. But the bully stole my brother's Star Wars lunchbox and also hit him with it. And I missed it. I was walking home from school separate from him. And he came running up to me. He told me what happened and something inside me snapped. I ran back to that little kid. And because I had been watching Wonder Woman and Charlie's Angels and Police Woman and pretending to be brave, I actually became brave. And I know it was because I had practiced the concept of fighting for justice, of somehow digging into this inner superhero, which I thought I maybe had, but I was a kid. What did I know? But I did it. And when that boy attacked my brother, I grabbed the lunchbox back and I slugged him on the playground in front of all the kids. And I grabbed that lunchbox back. I gave it to my brother. We went home. I got in trouble because the teachers also saw me. And my dad said, you know, violence is not the answer. But I just thought to myself, it might not be the answer, but nobody's ever going to touch my brother or I again. And they never did. So, but what I did take away from that was that I practiced being brave. And when the time came when I needed it, I was able to jump into action and become brave.
That is such good advice. I think we all need to take those moments, get over the small fears because you never know with the big moment of bravery. As we wrap things up, I want to note that you have a pretty intense adrenaline-driven life. You must have moments where you decompress. How do you do that? How do you turn off your brain, which is always working? How do you stop organizing the world and just take a break? What's your secret for that balance?
Thank you for asking. And it's such an important thing. And I think we all need to discover what that thing is that gives us that peace and that balance in our lives. For me, I am a mosaic artist. So I have an art studio in the back of my house, and I go outside after a tough investigation and I break glass and ceramic mosaics. And it's it's a very physical art form, because you have to, cut things, glue things, grout, seal. It's very physical. And that really helps mm-hmm. me. And I also like the concept of taking broken things and making them whole. That is a real...
I love that.
It's kind of a parallel with my own real life. You know, I am a broken thing. I've had trauma. I've had a lot of pain, and I've endured some things. So I'm taking the broken thing of who I was to create something whole. So that's why mosaics appeal to me. But that is the thing that I love to do, is make mosaics. And the other thing is I drink wine. So those two things balance me.
To do them together, or do you try to keep those separate?
Yeah. A little wine, an old movie, put on some sports, and then I go out and break glass.
The reason why I laughed when you said you have to break glass and ceramics, it's one of those nervous laughs. But I've never until this one time in my life, I'd never thrown a plate against the wall or smashed something. But I had a really hard situation. 2014, a close friend of mine at the law school I used to work at, my closest friend there, took her life. It was devastating to all of us. And they talk about the stages of grief. And there's a disbelief, but there's this kind of primal anger that you can feel. And we had some old plates sitting around that weren't, things that we'd use for plants and things like that. And I remember going out back and just smashing them against these rocks we have in our garden. And there was nothing more satisfying than that. And I wasn't going to say anything to you just now, but that was just flooding my mind. And in the interest of the sort of why not be honest? But I like the idea of taking those pieces. I like the idea of that not being the end, being broken down and devastated by that situation, thinking back on how things felt and thinking about how you can piece a life together and through art. So I may try doing some smashing and putting things together. But how do you come up with if I were going to start doing a mosaic, how do you begin? Do you have patterns to look at? Or
yeah, I originally went to a weekend workshop to just learn the basics of how to cut glass, how to use a wheel cutter, how to grout, mm-hmm. How to create designs, what kind of substrates you need and all of that. So I took a weekend course, and from there I'm self-taught. I went out and bought about 30 books of different types of mosaic techniques. Mm-hmm. And I discovered the look that I like, which is, I'm Latina, and a lot of my home is Spanish style. So I really am connected to mosaics that look Spanish, that look like they have some basis in old Mexico or South America. I have a line uh-huh. of Fridas. I've made these beautiful Fridas. I believe they're beautiful, and they're wearing real jewelry. Ooh. And each one has a locket, a vintage locket. And inside her Frida locket is a picture of her and Diego Rivera, her husband. And so it's kind of interactive mosaic art. So I know you're on a... you're on a podcast and you can't see, but here's one of them. She's at my desk. And there's one of her.
Gorgeous. Oh, I love that. Oh my gosh. I love the front of the locket with a skull. Oh my God. Like Day of the Dead. I love that.
Thank
Lisa.
You. So that's some of my work.
Well, I need to tell you, you have to go somewhere. One of my favorite places on the planet in Detroit, because I'm from Michigan, as I mentioned, at the Detroit Institute of Arts, there is this thing called Kresge Court, and they have a mural. This fresco that Diego Rivera painted, it is the most gorgeous thing. I love standing there and looking at all of it. I think it's called something Industry or the Industry Mural. I have to look up the name of it, and I'll send you information. But I love her. I love his work. And I also noticed in your book, you mentioned how you like Gaudí, the architect. And I've never been to Spain, but I want to go to Barcelona just to see Sagrada Familia. Have you been to Barcelona?
I have. And that's one of the things that inspired me to learn the art of mosaic, because my ex-husband and I had gone on our honeymoon to different parts of Europe, but we ended in Barcelona, and that's where we did see Gaudi, and we did, and not only the entire city is covered in his work and fan art, I guess you'd call it, other types of mosaics. And one of my dreams is actually to go to Italy, Ravenna. They have masters that do week-long or several-week-long mosaic retreats. And I would love to go to Italy and do a mosaic retreat. So anybody, you want to come? Let's go. Let's get some girls together and go do mosaics in Italy and drink wine.
You know what? I have a book deadline this summer, but I feel like that should be my reward for finishing writing, don't you think? Okay. Well, I will connect maybe next summer because I'm a slow writer, even though I have a deadline. But absolutely. Oh, I love this idea. What a good plan. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me after you just got off your flight. And good luck on the rest of the book tour. Everybody has to read Warrior, My Path to Being Brave. I'm telling you, it's so inspiring about, you know, taking a broken person, making her whole, but also how to do career transformation, how to get in and out of relationships, and just how to be a good friend and support to your female friends. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Can I just thank you too for what you do and we kind of met online on Twitter and I'm just such a fan of you and what you're doing and what your messages are. And I know we didn't go down that road today, but I just think it's so important for women to have a voice, for women to share their thoughts and experiences as much as we can. In my case, I got to write a book, but even if it's like following each other on social and supporting each other and just, you know, being there to validate what our experiences are. I think that's so important. And congratulations on your podcast. So happy for you.
Thank you so much. I am so glad I had that opportunity to speak with Lisa. It was quite an emotional roller coaster. I have to say that I almost broke down into tears when she was telling her story about her miscarriage, about finally finding her mother's jewelry and that safe deposit box that her father opened with her. We only touched on a few of the really interesting stories about her career. There's plenty, plenty more that I didn't even want to ask about because I want you to have some surprises when you read Warrior. She is an incredible role model. She is really open about her emotions, about mental health, about relationships. I cannot recommend this book enough. So I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. Even if you are not Jordan Belfort, I do want to hear from you. Send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com or write to me at bookedup, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with our show and featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It will really help other people find us. Thanks for listening.